Welcome to the latest episode of Inspiring Futures. My guest today is Peter Semples, Chief Marketing Officer of Depop. Peter, thanks for getting on the show, being on the show, being a guest.
Thanks so much for having me.
Really fascinating. We had a little bit of a talk earlier about your career trajectory. You've done a lot of interesting things, been in a lot of interesting places. Do you want to take us through a 30,000 foot view of what got you to where you are today?
Yeah, sure thing. I mean, it seems like it sort of makes sense now that I look back on it, but some of it was obviously pretty serendipitous along the way. Came out of university sort of wanting to be a writer and had sort of dabbled with music journalism and things of that sort before, and decided to kind of go into advertising on the copywriting side initially, thinking, oh, I could apply writing and creativity to sort of some version of business impact, and I could sort of maybe see a career there versus sort of just being a writer and attempting the kind of fiction writing thing. So was lucky enough to sort of land in a relatively small sort of a startup agency where I did a bit of copywriting, but I also sort of learned the ropes on the strategy side, the brand creation side, and the client management, a kind of internal stakeholder and external stakeholder management side. So I did that for a few years, and it was an incredible experience of learn as much as you possibly can, take on as much responsibility as you can. The business was growing fast, so they just kept chucking more stuff at me to learn. And in my mid-20s, I decided to move to New York. I loved my job, actually, and I loved those folks who I work with. It was an agency called VCCP, and some of those folks are still mentors to me all these years later. But I wanted to live in New York because it was where the music I loved came from, and I was fascinated by basketball, and I was fascinated with sneaker culture and all of these things that felt like they really had their cultural home in New York. So I guess I was 25 and I decided to move over there, and the folks I worked for in London tried to make it work such that I could kind of stay with them, but it was a bit too early in their journey to think about a kind of American expansion thing. So I ended up, through some of them, meeting and ultimately working at a place called Anomaly that was an interesting mix of marketing agency that I'd been familiar with, but also IP development and a real focus on entrepreneurialism and new ideas to kind of solve business problems. So learned a different skill set there, and was lucky enough to sort of land in a role that had me looking after Converse and Nike. So I got to do stuff in my professional life that was community and was sneakers and was music and was basketball. More luck than judgment, but I was very happy that it happened. So a few years there, learned a lot, specifically around community marketing and I guess culture marketing before anyone used that terminology, sort of investing in cultural resonance first and foremost, and then believing that you could see or ideally measure some of the impacts from it. Took a not entirely detour per se, but a sort of interesting different other role at Google Creative Lab. I was there for sort of 7.5 years, and that taught me a number of things. It helped me hone marketing for sure, and I did some traditional marketing. I did some community marketing. I also did a lot of things that bled into product creation and product iteration and working with product teams and understanding product, you know, sort of development cycles and seeing the kind of incredible magic that was possible with some of the smartest engineers on the planet. So I had this wonderfully variety kind of 7.5 year experience there working with unbelievably smart people in lots and lots of different spaces. And then, you know, gets to 2018 and I met the then CEO of the business I'm at now, which is Depop. This is a business that's a secondhand market place for fashion. So it's an app and it's a website where people peer-to-peer buy and sell fashion, primarily younger audience, but the opportunity for people to choose resale over retail grows daily. And we want to bring more and more people here because it represents a behavioral shift that's ultimately kind of good for people's fashion consumption and good for the impact it can have on the planet. And I've been here for 5 years, and my role here has been chief marketing officer in its early stage, then chief brand officer for a couple of years, then chief marketing officer again, as we've changed the way we manage the business and the opportunity ahead. And it's this interesting culmination of the things I love in my personal life, fashion, music, culture, community interaction, creativity, technology, and all of those things coinciding to hopefully build a business, which we're doing, but also build positive impact for or positive kind of behavioral change for the fashion category, basically.
A sec, I was on mute for a second. Going back to, well, I never know when a siren's gonna, you know, this is New York, you know, you never know when a siren's gonna strike.
Yeah. Remember those days fondly.
Yeah. Well, going back to your kind of roots and your sort of initial like writing, you know, you what how has that served you, do you think? Is that become a very valuable part of what you do, an important part of what you do? Does that make you a better collaborator with people who write? Yeah, because I wonder, and I wonder how important you think writing is in this day and age.
Well, as I say, I feel like as I'm now the ripe old age of 42 and I reflect on these things with the kind of context that hindsight gives you. I mean, I'm fascinated by language, and I think that in some respects, directly or indirectly, led me to pick a career where communication and the way you phrase things, the way you frame things, you know, leads to adoption or doesn't, basically. So leads to success of a business or a product or doesn't. I think, funnily enough, it's also probably why I love hip hop and why I've kind of fell in love with hip hop over the years is because of the language side of it. So I kind of think a lot about, you know, communication matters, the way we say things matters. You know, a lot of the things that we did at Google were, or a number of the things, maybe not a lot, but a number across the 7.5 years were looking at emergent technologies and thinking about how they could be shaped to take them to market. It was sort of what's the brand iteration or creation thing around this new technology that did a thing that no one ever tried before, and how do you make it land in a way that's going to be compelling or attractive or engaging or certainly not terrifying, which sometimes these technological advancements can be. So I think the obsession with writing and language has been really helpful, and I've really enjoyed doing little bits of dabbling in copywriting. And I still occasionally, perhaps much to the chagrin of my creative directors, intervene on the way things are communicated for our external audience or even with our internal comms team. Of course, I have a point of view on how we say things, but I fundamentally spend my life thinking about how you talk to people in a way that compels them to take action. And I'm lucky, I think, in my career, businesses I've worked for, the business I'm part of now, where I like to think I'm not selling people things that are non-beneficial for them. So it's not sort of talking them into stuff that's not good. It's actually helping them understand the opportunity that lies ahead, or in the fashion space, hey, there's a really interesting better choice that simply didn't exist 10 years ago that technologies like Depop can offer. How do we frame that to a way to people in a way that they're like, yeah, this sounds great. I want to give it a shot, you know?
What about the sort of flip side of that with the sort of internal, like you've got a big company, you have big companies, you're working on big brands, Google is massive. You know, people don't even know what a brand is half the time.
I mean, there's a, yeah, sorry, you carry on.
I just saying people don't know what a brand is, and then you're trying to explain how you're going to communicate it. It seems internally there's sort of like some significant challenges, especially in some more technology engineering companies where they're like, no, it's not really about that brand. It's about the benefits and the speeds. And this is a 200 times faster way of accessing the internet.
I think, I mean, one of the things I loved about Anomaly, which I touched on, is that they thought about solving business problems and how you kind of applied creativity in whatever form that might. And there might be actually a new kind of business approach versus a kind of brand artifact or a piece of communication specifically. But that theory of thinking about business problems and broadly trying to kind of, I guess, navigate, not always successfully by any stretch, whether you're arguing about brand itself and the strength of brand, but more what is the thing you are trying to bring to people or convince people or introduce people to? And can you do it in a compelling way? And, you know, as a deep believer in brand, I think brand is the answer for that. But within technological organizations, sometimes the word brand can be a kind of call it turn off or a distraction for a conversation that is fundamentally about, can we explain this thing in a way that people are going to like? And will they understand what to do with it? And will they tell their friends about it? And what's the kind of combination of pieces of language or sound bites or thoughts that we want them to carry forward? So at Google, actually, it was fascinating because obviously, the proliferation of Google Docs, as we've all seen over the last 10 years, but internal culture with Google, I joined in 2011. It was already, as you might imagine, using things like Google Docs far more significantly than the outside world was at the time. But you very quickly learned that anything you wrote down in a doc and shared with someone could find its way to anywhere in the business. Obviously confidentiality and stuff, there were things that didn't go far. But if you passed it on to someone because you wanted to get their kind of buy-in on your project, they might pass it to someone else. And you had to learn very quickly the skill, which I hadn't had to learn at kind of smaller agency world, of how do you articulate things that they're as bulletproof as they possibly can be, even if they come with zero context, which they so often did within Google. You put it down in paper, it wasn't the document would travel to Mountain View, or when I was in New York, it would travel to one of the European leadership people, and they needed to understand its value without you being there to kind of voice over the top of it. And I think that was a different experience from, in agency, you build the beautiful presentation and you practice and you kind of rehearse the speech. But within Google, you had to write something really compelling and really straightforward. So anyone, whether they were in the engineering team or the marketing team, or whether they cared about the brand or not, understood at least what you were trying to solve for the user. And wouldn't say my strike rate was perfect by any stretch. In fact, probably way more losses over the years than wins, but some really fascinating learnings about, again, that kind of power of, even if the audience is an internal one, how do you shape them? How do you sort of shape the language you're giving them so they understand what you're trying to solve and why what you're proposing might be a solution to it? Oh, sorry, Ed, you're on mute again.
There was a siren. There was a siren. You said sort of push back against brand. What do you think that's about?
Well, funny enough, had a couple of fascinating conversations internally at Depop about this exactly today. I mean, I think because the definition of brand is so various, and I like to try and think as brand as, if I think about it within Depop, the brand is not simply what the ads we make or the kind of community interactions or the activations we build, what they look like. The brand is actually the thing that people interact with. In fact, most of the touch points of the brand are broadly the way the people use the product and talk about the product day in, day out. So I try and think about the connected brand experience that we offer people. And in, conversations with my brilliant partner who runs the product and technology org, he probably doesn't think about it as a brand. He thinks about that as the product experience, but we're still talking about the same thing. So I think one of the issues is, of course, how and where people's definition of brand begins and ends. And then specifically within the marketing sense, you obviously have the kind of the age-old battle, and we live through it here. Sometimes in battle, sometimes in obviously very kind of constructive discussion, but it's sort of like if you have a dollar to spend, do you spend it on this future-facing, long-term view thing called brand that you hope will deliver engagement and value for the business growth over the long term, or do you put it into the thing that can bring you a dollar back tomorrow? And that's where some of these sort of difficult and divisive brand versus growth conversations obviously take place in all of our lives and in every business I've ever worked for at different ebbs and flows of the business. So I think the brand thing becomes contentious depending on how the business context is at the time and who you're talking to. But fundamentally, I think, and I know you believe this too, that you can't ever act in the absence of a brand. Your choice not to invest in the brand is leaving people to kind of fill in the gaps of what they think the brand is themselves. And that, hey, you might get it lucky and they might figure it out and do a really good job of communicating on behalf, or you might miss the opportunity to sort of relay the role you want to play in their lives and, as I say, give them that version of your business to carry on and to talk to people about.
Yeah, it's really interesting is I know we both have a history with Converse. And wasn't so long ago. I mean, because you and I kind of come from speaking the same language, we're on the same page. This is a brand that grew up from the grassroots, really had not been supported in any way by marketing in the traditional sense. But when you go to the website, it's a storefront, and the story of community and the story of the grassroots, and it's lost. It's buried on a tab somewhere that you would be very lucky to find, because it's all about selling product.
It's funny enough, my personal experience with the Converse thing, which I loved, and it's a brand that I still love, although I'm wearing a pair of New Balance right now. But the interestingly, the time I worked with Converse, there's a brilliant CMO there called Jeff Cottrell, and he was a real believer in, invest in the community, give back to the community, and they will pay it forward
They
and it
did the
will be
recording
long-term.
studios, and they did.
All of that stuff, exactly. That was sort of the era I was part of, and we did these fascinating things of, get musicians to play 3-on-3 basketball tournaments and create content, all of these things that, you and I have worked on across our career that would have been even more powerful in a world where social media existed to proliferate their spread. Those were the days where you still had to call bloggers and get them to come down to the event to cover it. But what was really interesting is we did all that incredible stuff, and it contributed, I think, to the cultural resonance that Converse had at the time. But Converse was also already having a moment. Fashion had shifted as it does towards skinny jeans and Chuck Taylors, the resurgence of rock and roll happening in New York City, and the Strokes and the Strokeification of music at the time, all of which meant Converse was sort of making money hand over fist. And we definitely contributed to it and kind of bolstered that kind of community spirit. But then a few years later, when the pendulum swung as it did to Vans, or I think Adidas was kind of coming up, then I'm certain, and I know for sure that the conversation started happening within the Converse HQ of, wait, these brand investments or community investments that are hard to quantify, maybe we need to pull back from them and go straight back to more traditional kind of retail marketing and double down on the dollar that we know about. And I think that's, and I think those the cycles that fashion goes in with the cycles of brand and business performance. It's easier to invest in brand when there's positive momentum and there's a little bit more money in the system to believe in investment in the long term. And then, Converse obviously has, I should know, but I can't remember when it was created, 100 years, 200 years, 1924, something like that. Maybe it's the 100th anniversary. I don't know. But they have a lot of cultural narrative that kind of carries forward. So most people who land on converse.com have some sort of context, even if it doesn't present it on the screen. But that doesn't last forever, or it can be outshouted by someone else telling a more interesting brand story as of this moment right now. And I suppose that's where, I'm a long-term Nike fan, but Adidas has really taken the shine from Nike a couple of times in the last 10 years because they've told a better story and they've engaged people in a better way. And Nike's been on the back foot, which they may or may not be at the moment, I guess.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. As you said, it's the ebbs and flow of culture in the fashion cycle. Going back to, so I think when we started talking about this whole idea of this brand is the totality of the experience, people are spending, they probably, your customers probably experience a brand through the UX and all the other things, that form of engagement, more than they do with any ads you do, was kind of right. So how do you, I think the sort of interesting thing for right now is, how do you think it's important to codify that internally? I mean, people also traditionally have brand guidelines. Is that useful? How do you sort of, how do you know what's on brand and what's not on brand, and how do you make sure that people in the organization know that?
Well, I think, I mean, one of the ideas that I'm certain is not my original idea, but
Yeah,
I've
sure.
held to be true is, of course, that, the brand is a constantly evolving thing and you need to constantly evolve it because the needs of people and the context in which people are living is consistently evolving. So you should have principles and purposes and values that largely remain unchanged, but the way in which you need to show up in the world will change across the course of time. So, I mean, actually, the room I'm sitting in now, you can't see any of it that I will maybe I'll share to you at some point. This is, we're sort of in an interesting, I don't know, inflection point maybe overstates it, but there's an interesting opportunity given where we are as a business right now for us to think about what does the next chapter begin to look like and what do we keep that's been really working for us. But as circular fashion reaches newer and newer audiences and different demographics, and you know, it began with the super fashion interested people and younger people, but more people are coming to it. How do we need to think about reshaping ourselves to be the answer to those folks or to help them discover and take part in the category of secondhand fashion? So we're actually sort of doing this project right now, which is the kind of next iteration of the brand guidelines piece. And I don't know really know what to call it. Like the brand guidelines thing has always slightly annoyed me. We used to have this document called Depop 101 because I felt like that was a slightly better framing of, hey, here's some stuff you need to know that's important to us when you think about making decisions on behalf of the business. I think what's fascinating about, you know, I've been at Depop for 5 years. The business has existed for just over 10 years. Leadership's changed and ebbed and flowed in my time. The thing we're trying to do now is really make sure that the sort of the story we're telling externally really does flow through into the product experience of tomorrow that we're sort of building. And that wonderful divide that exists in many companies and did exist at Google, and it's sort of why my team at Google sat between kind of product and marketing, but really intent on building a cohesive Depop experience for tomorrow. That means that, as I say, the things we do on the marketing side really have to be reflected, and the story has to continue, and the journey has to continue through the product side. So you need some guardrails.
It's really interesting.
And
It's really interesting
sorry.
that if you look at Nike, for example, go back to sort of like what their sort of founding principle or what they call it, a mission vision. Some of these people can tend to get confused with what is what, but it says something like to bring inspiration and innovation to every athlete. And then there's that famous asterisk which says, if you have a
If you
body.
have a body,
And you think how kind of how that just hasn't changed. What's changed is the context around it. The athlete has changed. What inspiration means has changed. What innovation means has changed. So they've evolved the brand by looking at those sort of almost like those pillars, the foundation pillars, but the actual language of who they are and what they do hasn't changed. They've just moved. I think they're, despite, you know, we know they've got challenges and issues right now, but in a business that's, you know, they've been around a while. Yet they retain cultural currency.
I mean, I often I'm a sort of as a long-term and perhaps recovering now sneaker collector. I'm the hugest fan of Nike. I was very happy and lucky to work alongside them with brands like Converse. I've always sort of maybe aspired to one day working there because they've been such a powerful brand in my lifetime, as it were. And you're right, those things haven't changed. Their desire to be innovative haven't changed. And they've adapted. I'm certain, and you know this from working in lots of businesses along the way, that the ways in which internal people or internal teams or agencies working on behalf or business partners manifest that in a, you know, intention to be innovative. I don't know, there's probably been some missteps along the way. Nike has so many good examples that it seems like everything they do has been brilliantly considered. But I'm sure they've taken some erroneous journeys with that along the way. And I guess that's sort of the, I'd love it to be as simple as giving the principle of bringing the innovation inspiration part, but you then need to put a few more, I guess, guardrails in place to make sure that people execute with the right taste or capability, I suppose.
Then it comes back to this question of, it's very, and I know this is part of what your brand's about, because unity and your customers and your resellers, the people who are on there, it's a sort of, it's a very empowering, right? It's kind of almost like a third level of the internet, or it's almost like a feature. It's like almost like creator culture.
Absolutely.
And I wondered, you know, it's interesting when you look at brands these days, and they, you know, look at like a lot of legacy brands, they really seem to struggle with sort of the openness of the internet and social media and TikTok has provided, and
Yeah.
trying to like give up control.
Yeah.
Do you find that as a like a question that you end up asking yourselves a lot of where the balance lies, and you know how much
Yeah.
you're driven by your audience or drive your audience? It seems to be a very important question.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and again, it changes depending on the world around us. I think when I started, I had this kind of naive view that perhaps this, truly was a democratic, really community-driven brand, the voice of youth culture. It was a brand that, before me, the decisions that the founder Simon and the then CEO Maria had made had really made it engaging to this incredibly exciting new Gen Z audience that had only come online a few years before I joined. And when I got here, I was like, wow, this is incredible. This is the creator economy, it's economic opportunity, people can make money. It's sort of social media, but it's social media for a purpose, i.e., you express yourself, you sell clothes, you then have money either to buy other clothes or to do whatever else you would want to do with that money. So I think naively in 2019, I guess it would have been, I was like, I never want to make an ad and I never want anything to sound like it's coming from the brand. I just want the voice of our users to be the only voice that anyone ever hears, and I want them to talk for themselves and of themselves. And then across the course of the last 5 years, for a number of reasons, partly, of course, lots of the things that happened in 2020 brought focus to the need for brands to have a voice and to express where their value set lies and where they're willing to have conviction. And so you can't, it is naive to assume that the audience can do all the talking on your behalf. You also have to give some direction, I suppose, to the world as to what you stand for and who you are and what that looks like at any given moment in time. And then, of course, the other, interesting challenge with letting the community be the face of the brand is, and this is a journey we're on, is as you want to reach new audiences, how do you make sure that the audience you already have doesn't sort of exclude them? If you're the youth brand audience, or sorry, if you're a brand for a very young, cool, interested, fashion connected audience, how do you make sure that doesn't, deny the appeal of people who aren't young or who aren't fashion connected? And so this is where I think you sort of need, obviously, the you need to know who you are, which is the brand part. You need to know some of the principles of your interaction. And then we're so lucky that we have a really voracious audience, and we need to kind of guide them and then sort of balance out the things that they're brilliant at with the other messaging that we want to bring to the world. Again, actually, the room I'm sort of sitting in now is us thinking about circular fashion should replace more and more retail at scale. And in order to do that, it's really exciting that we have a very engaged young audience and they're unbelievably influential. And we know all the facts and figures about their spending power. And Gen Alpha is already sort of coming up. But I also want, I'm 42. I want my peers to shop on Depop and to sell on Depop and to adopt that kind of circular behavior. And some of the danger of being super young and cool is they're like, well, this isn't a place for me. And then you sort of miss the opportunity for the scaling of the business, but also the scaling of cultural impact. I actually sort of occasionally say that I would like to figure out how we, across the course of time, become the Nike of resale, where you can be deeply relevant on of the moment and tapped into a kind of cultural artifact or an interesting movement, but also ubiquitous. And Nike have done that, but it's, I mean, I guess they've been around for 50 years, so they've had a lot of opportunity to build the story across the course of time.
Yeah,
But
I always think of it as a sort of a credit and debit account, you know, a sort of, if you put enough stuff in the cultural cachet, you will keep your audience. You know,
I love that.
85-year-old can be going to a Nike outlet store and buying a pair of white sneakers and walking around, but at the same time, the coolest kids in New York can be going to a pop-up Nike just put up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's, that's, I
You've
would
got to
love
make
to.
the, I think as long as you put enough, you know, investments in building the cultural side, keep the aficionados and all those.
Yeah, and I mean, I think this is where, and obviously I don't believe there is a truly scientific answer, but this is a number of the conversations we have internally here is as we think about the audience ahead, and as we think about broadening our appeal, and as we think about these kind of new demographics that aren't even considering the resale category yet, let alone have heard of Depop or would consider coming here, what are the ways in which you interact with them and you invite them in without displacing the, wait, this was the cool, interesting thing that I loved because it was only full of cool young people in this. And lots of brands fight with that. We're, you know, very lucky in some respects that we began with Gen Z, which so many other brands along the course of the last 5 years have been trying to tap into. We almost have the kind of opposite opportunity, which is how to broaden beyond. And it's interesting thinking about kind of a holistic marketing mix of, call it media channels and investments in brand or culture or activation, and what combination of those things you have to believe works to do the kind of Nike thing that is both capable of having, I guess, giant TV ads or giant billboards taking over cities that appeal to everyone, but they don't lose the ability to kind of tap into a fascinating kind of music cycle that's happening right now.
Yeah. So how much of a role does what we call here in the United States consumer insight, you know, like to me, it'd be real. The fascinating thing is here, what is the barrier? What are the psychological barriers that are stopping people from being participants in this marketplace? And it seems a weird dichotomy between like Gen Z who are like turned Shein into a multi-billion dollar company with disposable clothing at the same time. They seem to coexist in parallel.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as you might imagine, well, one, we have primarily because we're a digital product with a primarily young audience. We have a very vocal audience, so a lot of the conversation exists out there for us to hear what they care about, what they don't like, what they do like, simply by monitoring the discussions that they're having amongst themselves anyway. Great import on UX research and audience and market research in order to be equipped to have a conversation with the people who are with us now or the people we want to be with us tomorrow. I think, you know, resale has, I'm really fascinated and I'm very happy to have played a part in building resale as a movement and as a kind of more and more ideally viable opportunity versus kind of traditional commerce or e-commerce. And some of the needs or concerns or blockers to overcome, some of them are universal across demographics and some are specific to demographics, but, you know, trust in resale, trust in peer-to-peer, the logistics and shipping times, all of these things are broadly universal, especially in a world where pre-pandemic it was kind of the way, but certainly post-pandemic we're addicted to the convenience of I can order this thing at 4 p.m. and it comes to me at 8 a.m. the following morning. And peer-to-peer has a long way to go to get to, when was the thing reliably shipped? Can you track it? When's it going to get there? Is it going to be in the condition I sort of expect it to be in? Do I feel like I'm getting value for money? So there's a sort of fascinating user insight. You know, none of those are exactly surprising, but how you can build trust or how you can kind of build confidence around those things is a long-term investment broadly for us and for resale as a whole. You know, even very functionally, like, is the thing going to fit? Looks really cool. It shows up, it's still in good quality, but now it doesn't fit. What do I do with it? We don't offer returns. So then you have to figure out how you could sell it on. So I think we spend a lot of time, as you'd imagine, trying to combine the kind of more structural ways of doing user insight that you might get from UX and brilliant UX team here with market research at scale, with then the, I'm very lucky on my team specifically, we have a bunch of people who are very tapped into digital culture, but also kind of fashion culture. And we do internal fashion trend and fashion theme reports every single month so that everyone has a sort of an understanding of the user landscape and the million things that they're being confronted with by other traditional fashion retailers. And then we do our best to distill that into the action, of course, of the content we create, or more and more the ways we think about how our product of as a resale marketplace differs or is more engaging and more exciting ideally than some of the other ones that you could also kind of go to.
Do you see
we listen sorry
Oh, you're trying
No,
to.
I was going to say, I mean, we listen to lots, and then it becomes a question as to how you try and make sense of the myriad
It's a lot of stuff.
voracious appetites that exist out there.
Do you see a future where brands come to you that you have relationships with a lot of brands and you become their sort of a conduit to their
Yeah. I
circular?
mean, we've sort of done, it's interesting, we've leveraged brand partnerships in a number of ways across the last 5 years because we were seen as this, oh my God, the kids are on Depop. And if a brand wants to get to the kids, we might be one way to do it. We've also, because we've been one of the people driving the kind of new appeal and the new scale of resale as an alternative and circularity as an alternative. That means lots of people pick up the phone to us and go, oh, we'd love to partner with you for somehow because you can help our brand reach a new audience or you can help our green credibility. And we've done a number of fascinating partnerships with across the course of the years, you know, Ralph Lauren and Adidas and Doc Martens and Tommy Hilfiger. We've turned down far more than we've done because even though all of them for us are an opportunity to reach a new audience and kind of drive exposure and drive the kind of mission of making the world circular, some of them have been more cynical, I would say, from external brand approach than we'd have liked. You know, as in people are like, hey, we're not really great at the green stuff, but if we partner with you, maybe it'll help us look
Well,
better.
greenwashing.
So I think, you know, we consistently, and we have a number of kind of interesting partnership conversations coming up for this year. There are lots of like-minded people out there trying to figure out what their path is. Those are really exciting for us, especially if they'll help us expand to newer and different audiences. I think actually my point about these kind of monthly fashion and trend reports, I've actually been having a conversation over the last couple of weeks about, wow, the quality and the depth of these things is so interesting because we're both, the team are both looking at the landscape that other people have access to do trend reports, but we also have so many data points of what is happening on the marketplace in real time.
You consider
These
it almost
reports are
predictive,
incredible. Yeah,
almost
they
predictive, right? And
yeah. And there's
these,
probably a commercial value to those if we were to try and
true.
turn that on as a revenue stream at some point. I mean, I just want to publish them because they're fascinating, but I'm sort of thinking about how we might use them in the future. But they're very valuable for us.
I think it's interesting that this idea of what do you think the what do you think the unlock is to is it just I mean how much work have you done? Because it seems to me like the cycles, I mean, you look at 1970 or 1670 as being this. I mean, I used to live in Marin County, and my landlord told me that he went to Marin because he went to clean up oil in this little town called Bolinas. It's a surfing town. And he said that when he was there, he remembers a woman, a naked lady with long hair riding a white horse down the street. So it was an environmental movement that was sort of kind of born at that sort of the 69, 70. And we also sort of ended up in a sort of a crisis of like economic crises. So economic crises and environmental like forwardness seem to go together.
Well, yeah. Sorry, carry on. But yeah, fascinating.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. Like what do you, because there's such a compelling story about the fashion industry and its environmental impact. But it's a very heavy-handed, right? It's a very, it's do you know how much and how it's made and blah blah blah. And it can get very heavy very quick, right? But then
I
there's the sort of the style and the economy, sort of like the value. I mean, I remember because I'm a little older than you. I remember like this store in London called Flip. Do you ever remember this place?
don't know, actually.
Yeah, it was like this giant American kind of like warehouse. You kind of buy these really like big jackets, and they used to come over in the container load, just and it was just like American, like they had classic Levi's, they had racks, and it was like a massive store, and you'd go in there and you'd pick up
Where
this.
was it? I'm not sure I do remember
I think there was one on the King's Road.
that. Right. I was gonna say, I sort of remember a couple of those things on
Yeah.
King's Road in the
You'd
90s,
go
yeah.
in there like for £10, you'd get like you'd think it probably looked like a piece of crap, but you thought it was like amazing. It's like it might have come from a dead body somewhere, but it was like a 1950s, jacket or all that stuff that it just seemed to be right for the times, and it just ticked a lot of boxes, as far as what young people were looking for at that moment in time. And it wasn't sustainability. I don't think even you knew what sustainability was.
No. I mean, it's interesting the kind of the reason I was going, with the, economic cycles and environmental sort of awareness or movements. I think, you mentioned Shein. If I think about the 5 years that we've been here, the economic downturn or sort of decline in economic opportunity that happened during the pandemic was a real boost to businesses like ours because people wanted cheaper things, which secondhand tends to be. Obviously, retail and physical retail and all that stuff was disrupted. So there weren't, and e-commerce supply chains were disrupted. So there weren't as many options. So people came to us, some of them presumably because they had nowhere else to shop. And then a number of people came to us because there's economic opportunity in adopting the circular economy. You can sell the stuff in your house and then that'll give you some money. And then you, as I say, you can either use it to buy more clothes or otherwise. So that economic downturn moment was really beneficial and it definitely rose the star of circular fashion quicker than we otherwise might have anticipated it happening. Then strangely though, you come out of the pandemic and then Shein exists, which you've obviously sort of talked about. And then Shein is so cheap that all of the kind of positive decisions that people had begun to make, God, I'm only going to buy secondhand and resale, this is a really good thing. Suddenly, secondhand isn't even the cheapest thing on the block. And because of Shein's quite kind of terrifying pace to market, you can have deeply on trend and you can have it in your house tomorrow and it costs you, I don't know, at one point, I think they were selling dresses for 23 pence. So to some degree, and then, and as you might imagine, Shein's rise was a thing we looked at and did have an impact on our business because people, that was there for when they were spending their money, like they had less disposable income, but there was an even cheaper option. And that's where cheapness and convenience overruled their desire to do the interesting things that happen on the resale side. But I love your thing about whether the jacket you bought from Flip came from a dead body. I think the thing I think we believe in here at Depop, and I think hopefully we have the chance to do, is make secondhand not just accessible, it's accessible in lots of ways through technology like ours, in ways that it wasn't back in, the times you and I were growing up. So accessibility, sustainability, conscientiousness, all of those things are definitely part of it, but we have to make it exciting in order for it to truly compete with the fascinating like barrage of fashion content that we're all exposed to on a day-to-day basis. And then, that excitement can actually come from, interestingly, the uniqueness of a thing that is, hey, you can kind of have a pair of dunks because everyone wants a pair of dunks, but wouldn't you like the pair of dunks that no one else has because it's not unavailable on the floor of Foot Locker right now? It's 10 years old and it's still in good condition. So you can kind of play by the kind of style norms of today, but be your own person. And most people want that to be the case. They don't necessarily want to be truly individual, but they want to be kind of individual. Or some things are better because they're worn in, or some things were just better made 15 years ago, or I don't know, these brands that are
Well,
now
lost.
defunct.
Well, I mean, the 23 pence dress is not going to last more than a couple
No,
more.
not at all. And no one cares about it, and a million different people will have it. Whereas, an Epic, the particular fit of whatever 1980s Levi's 501s that has never been replicated or reproduced, it's pretty epic having that thing. So the question becomes how you can kind of pitch that excitement at a broadly accessible level. I mean, nerds and collectors, there's lots of ways to kind of compel them to come to the vintage world. But I sort of truly believe we have to be both accessible and exciting at mass scale in order to coax people away from the retail that they've been conditioned to consume for decades, basically. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, it's really interesting because it takes me back to the sort of point of like what you're talking about, and it's something I didn't mention, but where you're competing against industry where image is everything,
Yeah.
and what you're talking about is story. Seems to be really interesting to me. It's sort of like, I think there's been a lot of good examples, like I don't know, they call it the Peterman catalog. It was like this. I don't know when someone in Seinfeld wrote
I
for.
was going to say, this is, yeah,
Yeah.
Elaine wrote for it in
Right, right. Remember that? And then
Seinfeld.
we had Trader Joe's. You have all these really wonderful examples. I mean, I know when I worked at an ad agency where one of my creative directors had a collection of these just beautiful, like it was the Trader Joe's catalog. It was some tool company, and it was like every little product and this amazing narrative. And they're just, if they're done right. But then again, you're up against this juggernaut of an industry where image is just the predominant,
No, I mean, I love that. I mean, as a total nerd for a number of things and a collector of a number of things, I relish in the story, and I think part of the compelling nature of the inventory that exists on something like Depop is, God, if you could only spend 2 minutes actually listening to, called the etymology or the provenance of where this thing came from. But not everyone has that attention span by any stretch, and our attention spans lessened by the day. And there's lots of shiny things in our face from, the images being presented by fashion manufacturers. So yeah, that kind of notion of how you cut through and are exciting and offer a different and better alternative, and simply, sadly, accessibility and sustainability and wanting to do good isn't enough in our current world to truly change your behavior against all the shiny, compelling things that we see on TikTok every day.
So
But it's part of it.
where does that leave you with the idea of influencers and celebrities and as playing a role? Do they have?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of we work with lots of influencers and celebrities. I mean, I and some of them are, call it influencers in, I suppose, the true definition of the word right now, which is vehicles for visibility, and their talent is engagement and eyeballs. And then a number of the others are influential in their way because they are meaningful musicians or meaningful creatives in a particular industry or actors. And I think you need a little bit of both, because you sort of need a bit of the substance and the story, and they're not just being a brilliant clothes source for the product. They're also part of the brand you're defining in people's lives. I do think, and obviously there's tons of literature about it, that the explosion of the influencer economy then lessens the inherent value of all of them, because there's just too many hawking all the products in the entire world. So, but there's a role to be There's a role for them to play as a visibility means, sort of an alternative to the posters of yesterday or TV. Like, you're still showing up. You're still showing up in people's lives. But I think we're at our best where we partner with, I don't know, we did a partnership with Olivia Rodrigo just before she sort of hit the cusp of her stardom. And that was fascinating, because she was so obviously this incredible, Gen Z representative, but wildly talented and capable of captivating and engaging large groups of people. We actually did a thing with Megan Thee Stallion in 2019, which is sort of just before, well, she had a big 2019, but she had a meteoric 2020 and 2021. And those are some of the things I look back on most fondly, because we're leveraging influencers, but people who, yeah, are truly engaging and truly kind of contributing to culture, I suppose. And I think that reflects well on us as a business. Part of the thing we actually have to figure out is we keep doing them slightly too early. And there's a danger in that, because then you maybe don't get the value. If we work with Megan Thee Stallion a year later,
Sign you
probably
didn't
will cost
sign
us a lot
a
more.
multi-year deal.
Yeah, exactly. We need to sort of get them locked in as
Yeah.
advocates. So yeah, definitely.
But yeah, that's really interesting. I go back to this whole I mean I remember conversations or reading things about like I mean you have to kind of like really force yourself to think differently, because the way we grew up, or I grew up within culture, is fundamentally different. And I just bought a turntable, and it was like I couldn't even remember how the thing worked or whatever. And then you sort of remember there are things called records, and you used to go to record stores, and that was actually the only way you could find out about music. And I'm sort of very in, I'm very interested in what technology has done to, because I mean people would say they the value of their status is not in what they wear, it's in how they communicate. But maybe that isn't necessarily true, because now how we communicate is so visual, so fashion becomes an important integral part of that.
Yeah, I mean,
I mean,
that.
look at like beauty is like insane, like the beauty business is
Yeah.
insane. That's probably gotta have been driven by like the visibility and social media and
Definitely. And I mean, I think, there's both the kind of visibility that influencers on social media give, the sort of the airtime that they give to the brands that rise and fall. And also the creation of social media, it wasn't around when you and I were around, and the sort of desire for everyone to express themselves publicly, not always necessarily to kind of, not everyone needs the clout, not everyone wants to be an influencer, but everyone feels like part of existence now is how you show up and how you express yourself online. So for good and for bad, I mean, social media is, yeah, has taught everyone that that's a place to spend time and that's a thing to aspire to do. And then as a brand and a business, you can kind of, yeah, kind of tap into the channel aspect of leveraging it. Again, it goes a little bit back to the thing I said earlier of, I like to think that Depop as a community-driven business is aligned with or kind of similar to social media in lots of ways, but it's sort of for a benefit versus just showing off. It actually, ideally is a path to entrepreneurship or creativity or economic means. And that makes it, I think, more interesting than visibility for visibility's sake, I'd like to think.
final question.
Hit me.
So I think one of the things that was really interesting, we've sort of talked about this idea of the brilliance of a platform is its power to scale. But when you start to get to fragmentation, you start to see people moving away from the big things that scale into their own spaces.
Yeah.
That becomes really interesting, but it also becomes quite challenging, because the because you want to be you don't want to be 10 brands,
Yeah.
and this whole idea of mass reach. I mean, we know we just come out of the Super Bowl where everyone's clamoring to spend money because it's the only mass reach
Yeah.
vehicle we have now, and everything's sort of disappearing into niches, which makes management and connection really complicated.
Yeah, I mean, I like your actually your. I mean, I think a lot about record stores because I love music, and the record store, the physical incarnation of a record store. You knew it as a place to go and find music, and it didn't matter whether you were into hip hop or whatever, Brazilian jazz. So there was sort of fragmentation, but it sat within a home, and you knew all of those things could exist. And ideally, the magic of the record store of yesteryear was that you'd go looking for the hip hop record, but then you'd stumble into, I don't know, some fascinating techno something or other that would help.
Serendipity,
Yeah,
serendipity.
exactly. And so I think at Depop and with the circular fashion thing, I mean, there are tens of millions of garments on Depop. There are hundreds of thousands being added daily, weekly. And things like TikTok, channels like TikTok, drive these very momentary and contemporary niches in, I don't know, Barbiecore or
Whatever it is.
the mob wife aesthetic as it currently is. And so the kind of the niches and the fragmentation definitely exist, but still there's 30 million things to sort of sift through. So if you want mob wife and you want leopard print hey, there's hundreds of thousands of leopard print things that exist in the secondary market and exist on a platform like Depop. So I think what becomes ideally really interesting is sort of building this, you know, the record store thing, which is like, it's all here and we can help you find it. Whatever you're looking for, there's an interesting version of it. And kind of the wonder, one of the wonders of being a secondhand retailer versus a firsthand brand is this mob wife aesthetic. I don't really thread about that, but it's having a moment right now. It's fascinating in lots of ways. But, you know, if brands are like, oh man, leopard print or tiger print are suddenly back in vogue in a way that we hadn't expected because of presumably some TikTok video somewhere along the way that went enormously viral, they then have to figure out how to make it really quickly to get it to the storefront. Shein's proven to be very good at doing that, but we can just literally merchandise the day after it happens. Hey, here's all the leopard print that exists in the secondhand thing, trousers and shirts and sneakers and hats and all the rest of it. So I like to think of the scale of the secondhand inventory essentially that exists certainly in the world, billions of garments, or in our world, tens of millions of garments, means that whatever you're looking for, you'll find a version of it. And so we can solve for fragmentation and niche and very immediate interest in the thing that I'm into today that I might not be into tomorrow. You can still buy it today, and you know what? You can sell it on and buy the thing you need to buy tomorrow, and you kind of circle in and out. So,
Yeah, that makes a lot. That's pretty interesting. Does that mean that you then have, do you see yourselves, how do you see yourselves in your relationship to your customer? Are you their stylist? Is that too much, or is that where you ultimately would end up?
no, I think, I mean, we talk about the inspiration bit, and obviously that's a word that exists in the
If
90s canon as well.
someone finds this certain item, then you might positive recommendations and suggestions as to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the great thing about being peer-to-peer and having been very community expressive, younger generation willing to and excited to present themselves online is often the things are styled in the way that people actually list them. So they show the garment, but then they also show how they style it. We can then help you find things like it or things that might work with it. And we're actually testing a new feature that's gone out to some of the audience around this kind of outfit inspiration. So how you kind of put pieces together. And there's infinite runway in terms of interesting ways we can kind of provide inspiration. And of course, then, you know, it's a little bit like the record store. You might know what you're looking for, but can we also introduce you to some stuff that you didn't even know to look for? That's epic. And I want to make sure that we give you the best recommendations, and we have a very good recommendation engine. I want to make sure that if you search for something, you find what you're looking for. But I also want to inspire, I also want our product experience to inspire you with, hey, you didn't know this, but based on how we expect, you know, how we think we understand you or what happens in the world right now, you might be interested to check out this thing that you never have previously considered. Again, I think the record store is a perfect analogy for you can find what you're looking for, but you can also explore and discover and get lost, and serendipity plays a big role in it.
Line up. Sorry, I've given you too long, but I have got one final question because we haven't talked about
Of
it.
course.
AI.
AI.
As CMO, do you see it as good thing?
Yes. I mean, I sort of, yeah, I mean, obviously my years at Google was sort of in the emergence of a lot of that stuff. And I was at Google when Google sort of obviously bet the farm on the future of AI, which was more terrifying then and less understood. But I mean, you know, we already use it in lots of ways. It's obviously a fascinating efficiency tool for a number of things, coding being one of them, creative writing being another. So I mean, I think there are lots of ways that we can use it to slim down processes that we have and to move quicker. And the teams are sort of, everyone, myself included, are getting better at that week in, week out, and using it to our advantage. You know, I think when we, if we want to bring more people to the circular experience and make everyone comfortable with being a buyer and a seller, like there's a great example is like the listing flow is a brilliant space for AI to be truly beneficial. You know, you're not, say you're a 42-year-old man like I am, maybe you're not confident in the style or how to upload this garment that you want to sort of sell, and not even entirely sure what brand it is or how to describe the color, you know, then that would make listing flows of only 2 years ago really challenging, because you're having to write the things yourself. Like, we now leverage AI expansively in the listing flow to identify the brand, to identify the shape of the garment, to identify the color more and more to
Have you seen
pose.
an exponential increase as a result of that?
Yeah, because, and it's, you know, it's, and it's sort of, it's a relatively simple equation. It's just a lot easier for people. So then more people do it more of the time. And so, I mean, I think I wouldn't remotely claim to be an expert. Our chief product and technology officer is fascinatingly deep in it, as you'd expect he might be. And kind of feel like I consistently learn from him new ways to use it day in, day out. But for us, if it can make it quicker and easier and simpler to participate in the circular economy, and then of course to find the things you're looking for, or you know, these auto, I don't know, even the kind of story we were talking about behind the garments, AI at some point can probably fill in the gaps as to, this was Levi's jacket made in 1957, and it's lived through these different lifetimes, and this was the cultural, like all of that knowledge and information exists that could be generated by AI. So I think there's loads and loads of ways for it to
So is
help
this something
people adopt.
is this something you think of that you can harvest your own data and build your own? Like, is that sort
That's
of the
interesting.
question of like what you have so much data there that
Yeah.
probably isn't easy to access? And I mean, could you imagine, like, this is a 10-year history. You've actually got a prediction engine that could be, I mean, you could you can you have a whole load of data that says whether like tiny white boots that were a phenomenon in, you know, how long, you know, how did they grow, and did they, and then you could like model. You've got an incredible map of like the secondhand fashion market that is just really, I mean, whether it,
No,
you,
I think
because I
that's
think what you
super
look
interesting.
for is the data. You probably look for lookalikes. Now, does this thing look like something that we've seen before? And based on what we've seen before, can we predict where it's going to go?
Yes, I'm
You're
actually not
really
sure we
interested.
are doing that. I mean, that's fascinating. And I mean, I think the again, it sort of comes back to how you help filter through the tens of millions of things that exist because of whatever people are looking for in that moment. And you're right, actually anticipating what people will be looking for tomorrow. To some degree, we used to do maybe a slightly more kind of analog version of that, whereby we would see searches in our world, and we've got a kind of number of graphs that prove this, kind of searches for, like, I don't know, when Salomon shoes blew up in 2019 and no one had really cared about them for a very long time, the spike we saw in people looking for them, because we have a very engaged fashion community, happened 6 weeks before any spike happened in Google search analytics. So you kind of had this a little bit of a, you know, maybe not long enough to really take great scale of action, but you had this slightly, oh, here's the
Early
next
warning
wave that's
sign.
coming. Yeah. And you're right, you could probably do a mass predictive thing that could help us inform merchandising, or, you know, and how we show up as a product, and how we, yeah, all of those things are opportunities, I think, to get people more compelled about the things that we offer in the resale. So anyway, I'll take that idea away and see what we can do with that. I'll let you know.
Well, thank you very much. That was a great conversation. We covered a lot of ground. It was fascinating. Really
Yeah,
appreciate it.
thanks, Ed. Thanks so much for having me. And I